Okay, I'm not really going to say anything new, so I'm this straight man.
You go to questions then?
You go straight to questions, yeah. That's, no, I thought that as there's a substantial number of astrophysicists here, that some background would be appropriate. So I think the most, for me, one of the most influential bits of data that have come out of paleomagnetism in the last, 15 years, I suppose this is this plot of the strength of the dipole field. It's derived from sediments over the during this last normal interval. And I think it had the same, exactly the same impression on Chris Jones as me when we first saw it, that suddenly, instead of the usual picture you think of the Earth's magnetic field reversing, because it's always drawn in this sort of diagram where here's a normal bit and here's a reverse bit and here's another normal bit, and you think of a dipole field as just sort of doing this. And obviously this plot shows something completely different, because not only is the fluctuations enormous. I mean, here, for example, factor of three in a matter of a few tens of thousands of years, and it's probably faster than that, because this is a compilation, this is essentially an average, a synthesis of a lot of sediment records. This business going on here is real as well. I think this is well established. Our present dipole moment is here, so it's still high. So there's all this panic about an impending reversal, which is all coming from this drop we've had since Roman times, is maybe a little premature. But the exciting, the thing we're talking about today really are the changes in direction. So these names here are identifications of places where the field sort of reversed and didn't make it and came straight back. And the last reversal proper, 780,000 years ago, is over there.
Those numbers on the left, four and stuff.
Oh, I knew someone was going to. They're exa-amperes per square meter. They're the dipole moment. All I know is that corresponds to a Gauss coefficient of 30,000 nanoteslas. These are in 10 to the 22 amp meter squared. Thank you, Gary. So I did know, really, but I don't see why I should. And so this rather arbitrary line here at 4. Every time the intensity has fallen roughly below that line, there's also been a wayward direction, which empirically is defined as the pole going more than 45 degrees from the geographic axis. And Fritz will show more recent data than this. When this came out, there were talks given at AGU revealing perhaps another 10 of these excursions, and I gather that work has finally, 10 years later, been published, and Fritz will show it. But the point is, the two questions we should ask ourselves. First, the geodynamo is extremely unstable. Why? And secondly, most of these excursions don't make it. So in that sense, it's stable. Why? So very briefly, a long time ago, I suggested that the geodynamo has a very efficient means of reversing the magnetic field quickly in the outer core. It's called convection. The overturn time is 500 years, and that's how long it would take the core to turn the field upside down if it felt like it. On the other hand, the inner core is solid, and you can only change the field there by diffusion, which has a timescale of 5,000 years. So with the sort of logic you're allowed to use in geophysics, 10 tries, one success. And so 10 excursions between reversals. And so the idea there is that, I mean, the analogy I like is boiling an egg. You've got a pan of water that's boiling away like crazy, and you're waiting for the heat to diffuse into the egg to cook it for 3 minutes, but the overturn time of the water in the pan is much faster than the time it takes to cook the egg. And, yeah, it's life isn't fair, but that's one of my most cited papers, not for the right reason either. What the paper was all about was to say that there's a real theoretical distinction between an excursion and a reversal. The only one that makes any sense is that a reversal is a complete field reversal from B to minus B. The excursion isn't. Okay, the stability. I got KK interested in this problem. KK Zhang interested in this problem next. There's a long history of this going back to Chandrasekhar, who showed that magnetic fields inhibit convection, rotation inhibits convection, but when you have both together, one can destabilize the other. And there's this classic picture of a critical Rayleigh number as a function of applied magnetic field for rotating convection, which has a minimum. And there's been speculation, a belief, a rather nice idea, that somewhere in this minimum where convection's easiest is where the dynamo might settle in what's called magneto-geo, sometimes strophic. I did a web search and half the people... magneto-geostrophic seems to me to be the correct full name for it, but I don't think we're justifying dropping out the strongest force. But anyway, and the idea is that this is largely associated with Al-Tayyab and Paul Roberts from a long time ago. But recently, Zhang and Jones pointed out that these studies were all done with force-free magnetic fields because they wanted to do a linear stability calculation and from a basic state that was steady. But if there is no such thing as a force-free field in a sphere with an insulating boundary, and these are magneto-convection, there's no dynamo, it's an imposed magnetic field. If you impose a magnetic field which is exerting a force, then you don't get a minimum. You just go right through zero and into magnetic instabilities. And so one thing, one point I'd like to raise that is not relevant to this discussion, but at some point we're going to discuss saturation and what saturates the magnetic field. And one idea is that this point here, where the critical Rayleigh number for magneto convection goes to zero, is a point we should look at as a possible point where a dynamo would equilibrate. Because if this were a dynamo field, at this point you start sucking energy out of the magnetic field and the whole thing's going to die. In a magneto convection calculation or experiment, you're putting energy in through the applied magnetic field, and you can actually drive convection against a stabilizing temperature gradient. So if we take that and actually look at this is another set of magneto-convection calculations, very simple, looking for the critical Rayleigh number, and it's multiplied by the Ekman number there to scale it. In this particular case, a very small change in the applied magnetic field can produce a rather large change in the Ekman number times the critical Rayleigh number. So these are calculations done in the regime where you can do them. Ekman numbers of 10 to the minus 3, 4, 5, and possibly 6 for magneto convection, if not dynamos. But there's every reason to suppose this is going to remain valid when you extrapolate to small Ekman number, because for this sort of study, for this sort of onset, we have the asymptotics. And so the idea here is that once you've extrapolated to the Ekman number of the core, 10 to the minus 9 or 10 to the minus 16 or whatever you want to take it to be, then a small change in magnetic field is going to produce a gigantic change in critical Rayleigh number. So the suggestion then, the speculation then is that if you had a dynamo operating, a small fluctuation in the magnetic field, a small drop in fact, raises the critical Rayleigh number, so the vigor of convection is reduced, and that will reduce the magnetic field strength still more. So that there's a potential for this instability, which I think, and I don't mind being corrected if I'm wrong, is properly called structural instability. So really the question here is the geodynamo structurally unstable, because the viscosity is zero. Okay, there are people in this room who think that that one over the square root of 3 is a small parameter. So 10 to the minus 9 is zero as far as we're concerned. So that's the idea, that it fluctuates up and down. And we went into, you know, some more detail in papers that were rejected largely because they said we couldn't do the calculations, which we can't. Okay. The second point I want to point out to you is again from observations, and again it's old work that we still haven't made much recent progress on, although we haven't been trying. Now, before I saw this, which by the way was never published, but we had a good editor of Nature in those days, and she was so annoyed by the referee she put it on the cover, but it wasn't actually published.
Whatever it is.
I'm about to say. If I'd been asked before this, was there any point in the paleomagnetists plotting an apparent pole position during a reversal, I say it's a complete waste of time, because the magnetic field is not dipolar. So what they actually do, you measure the field direction here, assume the magnetic field is a dipole of some sort, and then calculate where the pole is. It's how you move plates around and that sort of thing. So they're used to doing this. And I would have said it was a waste of time, except when you do that during reversals, the poles seem to be concentrated around the Pacific, which is a very bizarre result, which I'll now try and explain. And the paleomagnetists then did their usual going into denial thing as soon as theoreticians get interested in what they've done. And this is all based on sediments, which are unreliable recorders. The lavas didn't show a completely random distribution. But when you look more carefully at what they actually did, they are worried about having the same results from lots of different lava flows on top of each other that were all recorded in, let's say, a century, 100 years rather than 1,000 years, so that you're biasing the sampling. And so if they got two directions the same, they threw them all away except one, and thereby got a completely random set of directions. And Jeff Love spent an entire year reading 111 papers on this subject, and where he could establish, let's say, that these results were from different Hawaiian islands but were otherwise undated or with the accuracy you need, then it's a reasonable assumption that these two volcanoes didn't go off at the same time. And otherwise, if they didn't actually put their geology... I don't know why it keeps doing that. I'm not on timer. Then he actually rang them up and asked them where these lava flows were. And when you do that and filter the data a bit more, then you do get this sort of shadowy impression, certainly from the last reversal, but from the excursions and the other reversals as well, there is a preference for these two longitudes. So how can you explain them? Well, as it happened, we had a kinematic dynamo, getting into really ancient history, but I'm just embarrassing Graham before he stands up and does something more recent. This is a kinematic dynamo, and it's an oscillatory solution, and we're looking at the radial field at the surface. It's a very good model of a solar reversal, actually, because it oscillates. And it reverses as a dynamo wave, so this flux in mid-latitudes grows and migrates polewards and displaces the flux that's there, and finally you get the reversal. And it oscillates. Well, I can make a geomagnetic reversal, because if I change this meridian circulation contained in this flow by a tiny amount, less than 0.1% in kinetic energy, I get a steady field dynamo that has a field that looks just like this. So actually you can construct a geomagnetic reversal by sort of changing the flow for half a cycle, wait till you get to here and then change it back again, or change it to something else. These oscillatory solutions are relatively rare. We are trying to add some dynamics to it rather slowly. But the interesting thing there is that if you take that solution, let's take half a cycle, there's a reversal, and then you construct some paleomagnetic data. You do what the paleomagnetist... So here's somebody in Iceland, and he will plot that... His pole plots along this path where it says 1, and you take someone in Crete, and his result plots along this path here on the other one, which was to me a very surprising thing, but it's a result of symmetry. And number 5 plots over here, number 4 plots the same as number 1 over here, and Bozo Peninsula over there plots the same as number 2. And so as it's a model, you can actually do this for any site you like. And of course the interesting question is what happens as you go across... anything in this quadrant finds this path, anything in this quadrant finds that path. So these two quadrants give the same results. Those two quadrants give the same results.
Were you at midway? What would you get?
Exactly. Thank you for asking the question. Because if you're there, you get an instantaneous reversal. So because there's reflection symmetry in the solution here, you get this instantaneous reversal across the equator. There isn't reflection symmetry here. That wouldn't be a dynamo. But there is actually, there's near symmetry. It's actually a rotational symmetry of 180. And so here you get quite a sharp flip.
My question was actually Midway Island.
Midway Island. Midway Island, same as four. In fact, you don't in the last reversal. I think it's too close to this boundary. Midway Island, sorry, is up there. So you should get that one. You get nothing. I should say this is my last slide.
So no matter how long the time of reversal is, the different time between reversals. So your trajectory.
What are you calling a reversal? Is it the reversal that's seen by them or
right.
the real thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's right. This is instantaneous. It takes a different time for the direction to change, around in these different sites. But unfortunately, I don't think the dating is good enough to really measure that usually. So I said, all I can say is this works for the last reversal. So not only, more or less, there are only 11 points in here, but they do lie in the right quadrants. And also, what intrigued me was the ones near these critical lines, like New Zealand, doesn't reveal any sensible path at all, which, of course, must happen somewhere. And also, I think, also actually Hawaii, not Midway Island, but Hawaii.
Done?
Yep, I think so.
Questions?
Comments. So recently at CEA we have, I don't know if you have met Carlo Lage.
Yeah, yeah. He was number two.
He has made a lot of work on that, and he also recently published a very substantial review paper on this reversal versus description. So I can give it to you.
Yeah.
And he said that actually we can start to have good information on what is the reversal versus the description by looking at the ratio between the dipole and the cardioid. And it's almost seen that when you have a real reversal, the cardioid actually is taking over during this tilt period, while when you have an excursion, it doesn't. And it will take about 1,000 years to. Am I saying it wrong? Yes, I think it's what I remember
okay.
from that. About 1,000 years to have a real reversal.
I've worked with Carlo, and I mean that Nature article was his. Okay, he was the first author. I think he was the first author. But this business of quadrupole, what they're assuming is that the magnetic field is a dipole plus a quadrupole.
They have an inversion procedure. From what I understand, they go to L of 13, I think.
Okay, well, the problem here is, I mean, you can do spherical harmonic analysis in your head. It's degree four. And so the quadrupoles, generally, I find are very misleading. And I don't think they're there. And that actually relates, now I'm sort of getting ahead of myself because Fritz thinks they are. But, you know, I just don't. Those inversions, they'll pick out the first two harmonics. So, you know, I think that's.
They elaborate inversions and they seem to not consider just the first two, from what I understood.
Okay. Yeah, but they did those, they learned how to do those from us when we were with Leeds. So I think, yeah, I would be wary of the quadrupole.
But you believe in virtual dipole poles?
It's
not a scientific concept.
Well, no, you have to plot your data somehow. And as I said, I think it would be a crazy idea if the magnetic field is not a dipole to do it. Now, the reason this happens is because the magnetic flux remains concentrated around the Pacific. And it's where it is today. And there's a good dynamical reason for that, because the mantle's cold and the core is downwelling there. So there is a theory behind this that I haven't touched on, because there's a few dynamo simulations that do produce this. I don't know whether yours did, but I guess there was one paper of Gary's and one of Christensen's. You need to wear this.
Okay, we're not done yet. Alan still
has one here. So you indicated that there would be feedback on the convection by the magnetic field, the configuration of the magnetic field.
Yeah, what's going on there is actually dominated by the change in the length scale of the convection. So the magnetic field increases the length scale of the convection. If it weakens the length scale goes down, and that's less efficient convector of heat. So the critical radii number goes up.
Is it primarily a matter of the field strength or the angle between the rotation axis and the magnetic axis?
Well, it's the field strength. I mean, I don't know. The reason in the Earth why the dipole moment seems to be away from the geographic axis is because of the inner core, and because most of the magnetic field is generated around the inner core. And there is at the moment a bias of where it's generated, I guess, towards wherever it is. Canada, I suppose, is where the pole is at the moment.
One should mention perhaps that the dynamo magnetic field really behaves very differently from any imposed magnetic field. And so far, I think all the correspondences which one might have expected didn't work out. So the dynamo magnetic field is really different from the
But the trouble is we can't go to low enough Ekman number to test that. There's this idea of structural instability.
So how much of that clustering in those last couple slides is real versus an artifact of your observers being in special locations? Because there are real clustering of the...
Do you mean talking about the data or the last slide, which is the model?
The data.
In the data... The reason they're clustering first it tells you the field is not a dipole when it's reversing, because otherwise everyone would get the same path.
Right.
Everyone gets different paths. If there's a preponderance of two, then there's another symmetry in there, and what this shows is that certainly the symmetry of having flux continually concentrated around one great circle will do it, because it reinforces this measurement from both ends. You know, essentially they're hanging a magnet and looking at its direction. It's pulled from both ends. That symmetry is needed.
Your last question: how nonlinear do you think the system is? How far above criticality are you with the real Earth compared to? Now, very often it's tempting to say, well, here the stability diagram changes character, and therefore the thing that is 10 decades away in parameter space should respect that.
Yeah.
Have you evidence that you...
Yeah, there's two estimates, one by me and one by Chris Jones. I don't understand his, but he's not here, so I can say that. Mine from energy considerations on the Rayleigh number, and his from the observed core flow speed. And we both come out with the same Rayleigh number, which is, I suppose, about 500 times critical. But interestingly, they are both approximately equal to the critical Rayleigh number for non-magnetic convection, assuming turbulent diffusivities. Whether you think that's interesting or not is not a matter. Now, the trouble is that's all heat, and there's the compositional convection, which probably means it's a much higher Rayleigh number somewhere else. We can't say that much about.
All right.
Yeah, I want to present a new proposal for reversals based on full hydrodynamic calculations, convection-driven dynamos in rotating spherical shells. And the outcome will be that the Earth seems to behave much closer to the Sun as we might expect, because traditionally we distinguish the Earth dynamo as a steady dynamo from the solar dynamo, which is an oscillating dynamo reversing every 11 years. And what is the outcome of the kind of calculations which I want to present, which have been done in collaboration with Radosin Simitev, is that the Earth dynamo may well also show these reversals, these oscillations, which sometimes manifest themselves as reversals, but usually just manifest themselves as excursion. I mean, as David has already pointed out, there's about one reversal for any 10 excursions. I just briefly put out this kind of equation that we're using and boundary conditions just to really mainly introduce you to the parameters. R is the Rayleigh number, tau is the rotation parameter, we have the Prandtl number and the magnetic Prandtl number, and we use a sort of a spectral scheme to solve. I mean, it's very much like Gary Glatzmeier has introduced the dynamo simulations. And the only thing is perhaps that the boundary conditions are rather simplified. We use stress-free boundaries and assume that the magnetic field is either the outside is either insulating, or the outside is always insulating, but the inner core will be either insulating or perfectly conducting. In both cases, one doesn't have to actually solve the dynamo equation for the core and gets relatively simple boundary conditions. And we will be using both cases, and in both cases, this phenomenon of reversing toroidal fields will be seen. Yeah, I will start off with the fact that dynamo oscillations are a regular outcome from those calculations. Here I just show an example. We see that, can we focus this a bit more? I don't know.
This might be underneath the twisting lens. There's a lens there.
I see. Yeah. Here's the flux, the toroidal flux, and here's the mean poloidal field, and you see there is flux tubes of opposite sign emerge at the equator and push the older flux tubes up to higher latitudes. I mean, here you see new flux being created at the equator and pushing up the flux. So these are the typical type of dynamo waves which have been used also for explanation of the solar magnetic field. And
what's the dynamo number?
Yeah,
we usually on solar we're talking about dynamo number.
This is the mean field.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the mean field.
No. That's sort of equivalent.
Yeah, I mean, I can give you a simple applications
what
of.
What is the magnetic, the real magnetic Prandtl number in the case of the Earth?
In the case of the Earth, the real magnetic Prandtl number is 10 to the minus 6.
So, why do you consider this to have relevance for the Earth?
I mean, I'm sort of talking about eddy viscosity. I mean, assuming that magnetic diffusivity is about the molecular one, when we assume that the kinematic viscosity is sort of an eddy viscosity, then I think this is not that unreasonable.
To get an eddy viscosity, you really do need some turbulence.
Yeah, I assume that the scales, which we don't resolve, present this eddy viscosity, but I think that the magnetic scales can be almost resolved.
But it begs the question: in this kind of system, is a simple eddy viscosity anywhere near an adequate representation of the unresolved scales?
I think
not just the generic question, but here you're going to have feedback from small to large.
I leave this for.
That's a very large question.
That would be the field theory.
I think that was one of them. I just wanted to show that simple model using Parker's dynamo waves gives a fairly good explanation. I don't think I have to go to the theory because it's an old one, but if we calculate the omegas based on the theory, you don't need this because this is an application of a theory which is 40 years old, I guess. But I just wanted to demonstrate that if you apply this theory, then it seems to describes the simulations fairly well. I mean, here's the simulation and here's this application of the theory, and for various rotation rates and magnetic Prandtl numbers and ordinary Prandtl numbers, you get a fairly reasonable correspondence. I should say that oscillating dynamos are obtained usually for quadrupoles and hemispheric type dynamos, but we are of course interested in dipolar dynamos, and they at higher Prandtl number especially are usually steady, but at Prandtl number of the order one or less you find those dynamo oscillations. Now,
do you apply this theory as applied to Parker waves or to mean in a
it's the Parker waves. It's just the Parker dynamo waves. Anyhow, these are sort of regular waves.
The kinematic solution I showed is actually, you can actually take it right in the asymptotic limit to the Roginski dynamo, which has the same equations, same mean field equations, and you can actually you can actually go as close as you like to, or as close as you can, the computing to that limit. So these, that's kinematic.
No, but these
probably obey the same sort of equations. There is a transformation you can do on the velocity given by Roginski in order to give you that sort of equation.
The important distinction is not really between mean field and things, it's between doing the mean field analysis in an infinite domain, which is what you're doing for Parker waves, and doing it in a finite and bounded domain, because the dependence of the frequency is very sensitive to doing things in a finite domain. Because it feels the poles in the equator.
Huh.
So maybe
it won't. Seemed to work fairly well in our case. Now, here I show now actual dynamo simulations, and here's the case corresponding to these parameters where the dipole moment executes these oscillations, and but it doesn't reverse. The poloidal field does not reverse, only once in a while. And in this case, this is a high Prandtl number case. I don't want to dwell on this. But this case down here is perhaps another case. This was actually obtained with the insulating boundary condition on the inner core. This was obtained with the highly conducting boundary condition on the core. And you see here again, perhaps a more rougher way, the oscillations and then once in a while reversals. And we will now look at this in more detail and see what actually going on there, because these are modified dynamo waves. You see the same phenomenon here, that new flux tubes are created at near the equatorial plane and push up the old flux tubes to the higher latitudes. But in this case, this happens a bit asymmetrically, and then you end up with fairly strong quadrupolar flux tubes. I mean, you see that this for dipole, the toroidal flux is always antisymmetric with respect to the equator. This is sort of more quadrupolar structure. And at the same time, you see that the opposite eddy of the poloidal field wants to make its way out. And indeed it does, but the polar field only gets somewhat weaker and then recovers again fairly quickly, and then this state lasts for a while until a new flux emerges at the equator and the whole play repeats itself.
So this intermediate stage is one of these hemispheric.
Yeah, I mean,
all the magnetic fields sunk to the bottom of this.
This is what I would call now an excursion. I mean, the poloidal field gets rather weak, and but it doesn't reverse. It recovers with the same sign, even though the oscillations of the toroidal flux seem to operate similarly to the regular oscillations which I have shown before. Now, once in a while, this same process happens in this way. We have again the emerging of this quadrupolar toroidal flux and the opposite eddy here coming up. And this time it is sort of more near the equator, and it splits the existing poloidal field, and then it sort of the poloidal field recovers with the opposite sign. And if you look this at from the outside, these are plots which are made sort of for the Earth's surface. You see that reverses of the poloidal field happens in this way. And one thing which I find remarkable is that the reversed poloidal field is first observed in low latitudes. The polar field has not yet reversed, but here you have already the reverse sign, and it takes a little longer for the full reversal to happen. And this seems to agree quite well with the paleomagnetic observations which have been presented by Clement. Now, I show another example now for this other case with different parameters, which has the insulating boundary condition on the core. And you see here again a flux coming up at the equator. It's sort of almost a bit hemispherical. And then this new flux then becomes dominant, and the poloidal field at first does not change, but then a new component, I mean already visible here, the opposite sign comes up and replaces the original poloidal field and gives rise to a reversal. And again, I mean, this reversal happens first at the low latitudes.
What delta G star mean?
Oh, that's just the time. I mean, this is actually done in magnetic diffusion times. Delta T equals 1 is one magnetic diffusion time, which for the Earth's core would be 80,000 years. And so these reversals take, in this case, these times of maybe 10,000 years. about that time, and how much time do I have? Oh, I still have time. So I want to draw your attention to the observations, which I hope I can find. These are the recent observations by Land et al. And you see here the intensity of the magnetic field actually obtained from two different oceanic drilling cores. The red one is one result, and the blue one is another one. And you see that both cores give roughly the same data. And here you see that all this minima correspond to excursions. I mean, where the magnetic field, the polar magnetic field gets very low, but then recovers with its same sign. And this happens here roughly, the time scale is given up here, 10,000 years, 20,000 years, and so on, roughly every 30,000 years. And I'm rather surprised that there is some kind of regularity here. But of course, one can't expect a regular period. The last reversals actually took place here nearly 800,000 years ago. And so I think there is a good chance, I mean, this is a relatively simple model and doesn't really prove anything, but I think there's a good chance that the excursions, global excursions, are the result of those toroidal flux oscillations in the Earth's core, and that once in a while these oscillations give rise to a reversal, and this seems to be borne out by this dynamo calculations which I have shown, and of course much more detailed calculations will be necessary to convince people that this is a viable process for the Earth. Thank you.
I'm trying to understand the solar and Earth analogy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In the solar case, dynamo is oscillating already at linear stage, kinematic regime.
Yeah.
In the Earth, to my knowledge, at this level, you have steady solution, and you produce oscillation only as a half bifurcation going into nonlinear regime. Why you say they're the same?
I mean, the Parker theory is a linear theory, and this kind of dynamo waves, if we can call them, behave like the Parker model seems to suggest. So I think that's why I'm calling it dynamo waves similar to the sun. Of course, in the sun, the dynamo waves propagate to the equator. If you apply this model, we have a different type of differential rotation here, which is has a storm.
You're saying you have oscillating solution at kinematic level already with your parameters.
I don't have a kinematic theory here. It's this full, but it behaves in this respect in terms of the oscillations like a kinematic model.
Okay, Andrew has a comment on this.
You answered Dave's kind of question earlier about the conductivity being infinitely in a core, if I recall correctly. Did you say that?
Pardon?
Can you speak a bit?
Conducting in a core, did you say?
Yeah, I assumed the boundary conditions which allows me not to solve the problem for the inner core as well.
Question. If you had a conductivity the same as the fluid, would that have steadied your dynamo up? I mean, as David was saying, Chris James and others have found that the conducting in the core prevents.
Now, we have done those calculations, not for this particular cases, but for several other cases. We have done calculations with the inner core of finite, of the same conductivity as the outer core, and then we found very little difference. I think we agree more with Johannes Wicht, who has already demonstrated that this Hollerbach-Jones mechanism doesn't seem to be relevant. I mean,
Steve was first in
mind. Just to follow up on Xander's point. So you're suggesting a new bifurcation scenario then for the reversals, because most people think you get the steady solution and that goes unstable, and then these two solutions somehow merge and you get a global bifurcation, so you get this kind of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Your bifurcation structure is an initial hot bifurcation.
Yeah, yeah.
And then something happens to kind of, if you like, steady up the waves. And it seems to be that you go through this hemispheric phase, this kind of...
There's a quadrupolar field. I mean, at least as far as the toroidal component is concerned, seems to want to come in, but doesn't make it. And this seems to agree with, I should perhaps say another observations. I mean, this, there are other reversals models which are very different, but seem to also involve the quadrupolar component. And this seems to also agree with whatever is available from the observations.
Just a comment then.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems very solar-like, and when the sun enters into a Maunder minimum and emerges from a Maunder minimum when the field is weak, it's very, well, at least the only observation we have, it's very hemispheric. You only have a butterfly in one half of the solar.
Yeah.
It seems to be very similar to what you have there.
Yeah. I may also draw your attention to one aspect here. We have plotted here, actually, this is the quadrupolar toroidal field, the main component of the quadrupolar toroidal field. And we see that whenever the quadrupolar field becomes particularly strong, then we may get the real reversals. These are just sort of more normal oscillations giving excursions. But then, here's, of course, the quadrupolar field is going strong in the negative direction, giving another reversals. And here again, I mean, there's the reversals coming up and so on. I mean, there seem to be this feature of this fluctuations.
Let me try my question again a little less pejoratively and more precisely. In this kind of rapidly rotating system, of course, I mean, it's sensible, I think, your approach of trying to make a kind of simple model of the turbulence of the unresolved scales, but one has to say it can't possibly be so simple as an eddy viscosity. There'll be other effects in backscatter, and that this should also be in some sense evolved or coupled to the reversal process in some minimal way. And I'm wondering how, you know, in some sense, how sensitive are the conclusions in this story to the, you know, to the model that you're using?
So we just check them. Do you have a subgrid scale model on this, or is it you just, that was just your excuse for having a large coefficient in front of the diffusive?
Yeah, no subgrid scale model.
He doesn't have it.
There should be really a dynamical subgrid scale model.
Yeah, he doesn't have a model.
And this is a discussion. In general, in these quasi-2D systems in particular, there has to be a small to large backscatter effect, right?
I mean, if you're going to put a subgrid scale model, and I agree, he's just using it as an excuse for the coefficient he's chosen for the Prandtl numbers.
But okay, and then does anyone worry about evolving that, say, by adiabatic theory or something during the reversal process?
I mean, in the turbulence community, yes, but I'm not sure in the geodynamic.
I mean, as a question, I mean, if we're talking about the small magnetic Prandtl number problem, which I guess is how it crops up. I mean, there's a question as to whether anything makes sense of small magnetic Prandtl number, whether to talk about this scale that lie below the magnetic cutoff scale as any sort of eddy diffusivity or any sort of.
Sorry, what was the ordering of the Prandtl?
And so.
A little less than 1.75, for instance, in this case.
Are we having a public conversation here, or is it that one at a time?
We're having a discussion.
Okay, well, let's carry on with this one.
It would be revealing, though, to try some simple thing like some kind of representation in terms of. I don't know, evolving an eddy population, whatever you want to call it, and see how letting that respond, what impact that has on the story, right?
If you have a good theory, then yes, it would be.
If anybody has a good theory.
There is a lot of work done on dynamic SGSQ.
I know, but I'm just curious why that doesn't filter into this problem, is what I'm saying, asking.
Yes. It's insulated. Okay, Yuri, you were next in the questions.
You have a range of rich behavior for small changes in parameters. You then select those that you kind of like and say, this is the Earth.
Yeah, I think the change of parameters was actually quite substantial, but if you...
Well, I mean, at least you showed us...
I mean, look at this case. I mean, here we have... This doesn't show very well. Tau is 10 to the 5, and these are the magnetic Pandelamba. Down here, we have tau factor 3 less, and the Rayleigh number is also factor 5 less than upstairs, and yeah, the Prandtl numbers, the magnetic Prandtl numbers differs only by factor 2.
Well, the question is, in somewhere in the sort of 3 or 4 dimensional, 5 dimensional parameter space, are there certain islands of behavior that are kind of steady, that are oscillating, that try to make it and don't make it?
Yeah.
That
yeah.
You're able to at least show to ask what. How much of parameter space is occupied essentially by this type of behavior?
Yeah, certainly we find when the Rayleigh number is slower, then we get more regular oscillations. And also it seems to be necessary to have a sufficiently strong rotation. 10 to the 5 is already among the highest we can easily reach with numerical simulations. That's about 10 to the minus 5. I mean, tau is one over the inverse of the Ekman number, yeah.
I find the suggestion that the power for waves are relevant very interesting, but I think it would be necessary to have a fully dynamic model for these power for waves to add credence to the power because waves are exponentially growing. They don't take account of the Lorentz that reaction. I just wonder if anyone has tried to do this to include, I mean, it might be through alpha quenching because he has alpha.
I think Hirschemura did first.
Is it?
Yeah, people did it.
That's one of the people, I think, Steve.
You can do lots of nonlinear Parker waves, nonlinear Parker waves in a finite domain, all of these things with various nonlinearities. You choose your favorite nonlinearity. And the thing that really makes a difference is whether you're in a finite domain or if you consider it to be an infinite domain. The nonlinearity seems to be pretty insensitive to the behavior of frequency.
Well, yeah, but it could at least stop the exponential growth.
It does. It does. And then you can look at the frequency. Yeah. You can plot graphs of frequency.
So that's, I think if you're going to make that sort of claim, I think it's important to look at kind of this.
Yes, I agree.
But then we have to see observation.
All right, one last comment from
observation. No, it's just a comment that at least kinematically, what the distinction between whether you get a steady or an oscillatory solution is largely depends on whether it's generating torsion and blowing field in the same place. And this goes right back to Levy and these mean field equation studies. But what we found in 3D. When we were actually dealing with waves that are asymptotically linked to the mean field equation of Dynamo waves, so they are actually Parker waves. At least this Dynamo I'm showing is actually we call it a Parker wave if you want, because it satisfies essentially the same equation. But in 3D, it's like adding an extra floor in your house. You know, you can have these two fields are probably much easier to separate in three dimensions than in axial symmetry. So. These oscillatory solutions became that are reported for the alpha omega equations are much rarer in 3D than in axial symmetry.
It's very easy to get oscillatory solutions in an infinite domain, and it's much harder, as I agree with you, to get them in a finite domain. And the nonlinear behavior is very different.
Well, we're going to
said that maybe we should suggest to the organizer of the meeting that we have a discussion, obviously, because a lot of people want to talk about subgrid scale models, and whether you want to solve the right equations, the wrong parameters, or the wrong equations, the right parameters, it's up to you.
Yeah, don't be solving the right equations. Whichever results is getting funding, how's that?
I could be too fast.
Or you can solve the right equations as right parameters, but don't just call it the other.
Okay, so I should just say before I really start, this is work done with PhD student David Ryan, who will be coming out here in a few weeks as an affiliate on this program. So any nasty questions, I'll defer to David's with us. Okay, so we're talking about a slightly different thing here. Rather than worrying about the statistics of, or rather than worrying about the process of an individual reversal, for most of this talk at least, I'm going to worry about the statistics between of long sequences of reversals. So going back longer in the paleomagnetic record, where we don't have intensities like Dave showed, where you could see the virtual dipole moment back through the last couple of million years. And all you really have is the times at which the field reverses. So all you can work with is the interval between reversals. So I should explain what these plots are. On the left-hand side, I've got the data we're actually working with, because what we've done is taken a set of reversal data from the literature and tried to fit it, and then tried to replicate the statistics of this with a very simple toy model, as I'll describe in a second. Okay, but just to show you the actual data, here on the left I'm showing the data of Gradstein and Og, 96, where this axis here, which you probably can't read, I'm sorry, is duration of event in millions of years. So the numbers here are 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on, are the gaps between changes of polarity. And this sequence here, which is about 350 events, is just the sequence of events going back over the last 166 million years or so, with the most recent one at the right back here is the last reversal in the sequence back in time. And somewhere in the middle, round about here, is the famous Cretaceous supercron, which actually goes off this plot. It was in fixed polarity for about 37 million years, so it would be up here somewhere, but we didn't want to lose the variations here. But you can see that throughout this period, it's reversed many times with quite a range of irregular intervals between reversals. And what people seem to do, or what seems far most common in the literature, has been to just locally, say near the present or at a certain period in the time, try to fit this as, say, a Poisson or a gamma process with just a local parameter determined by the local reversal frequency. But what we wanted to try and do was to see if over this whole set it couldn't be fit instead with some stationary distribution. So we took these data points here, fed them into a standard statistical package which is a number of distribution tests, and compared this set of data using the three tests, Anderson, Darling, Kolmogorov, Smirnov, and Chi-squared have listed here, to a set of standard probability distributions, including gamma and Poisson, but also including logistic, log normal, etc. In the paper that was on the wiki when we first did this, there was about 14 of them. We've since done it with a slightly different package, while also incorporating these other tests, which we didn't do at first.
Did you try a tail of power law?
I'll say something about that at the end, so if I can defer that.
Because log norm is a deficient.
Well, I'll say something at the end. So. We tried this with a bunch of distributions, so we found that for this data set, and also for another one, I should say, we considered a slightly alternative set of data where the intervals are slightly different just from disagreement of the actual reversal times. We found that the log normal fits this set of data quite well. So what I've got on the right here, again, please, if I don't explain a plot, call me up on it. On this scale, we've got the duration of these inter-reversal events. So these are just the times which are plotted here. The supercron out on the right, this is just a log scale. And on the vertical axis, we've just got percentiles. This is just a cumulative probability distribution. It's just been plotted in this particular scale which is set up so that the log normal, which is our best fit, appears as a straight line. So you should notice this is very stretched scale up at the top here, which obviously makes sense for the log normal because it is a distribution with a heavy tail, which is obviously what you're going to need if you're going to try and explain all these reversals, perhaps including the supercron here, with a single distribution. You obviously are going to need something which has a heavy tail out for long duration events. Okay, I should say this is not the only one that fits it well, but the other distributions which fit this data well, so they also have heavy tails just by this requirement. And even, I should point out, even excluding the supercron itself, you do need that to explain the other longer events. Trying to explain all of these reversal intervals with something like Poisson gamma goes wrong well before you reach the supercron itself. Okay, but log logistic also does a good job. In fact, it does a slightly better job accounting for the supercron. So it's not definitive that this is the best fit. It's just one that seems statistically significant and which we'd like to explore in the following. So why we thought this was interesting when we first got it was that these commonly arising simple physical systems or non-physical economic systems, say, where you've got the presence of multiplicative noise. And there's a very simple argument for this, which I'll just briefly talk through here. I guess the only controversial thing here is the fact that I've chosen to label this equation with the leading variables B and alpha, as if it might be related to dynamo theory. But suppose you just have some equation with some B varying in time, subject to a term where it's multiplied by some alpha varying in time, and we're going to have this alpha varying noisily. And then, okay, if you just imagine a simple time stepping of this, you're just going to get the next B in terms of B at the next time step, Ti plus 1 in terms of Bi, simply like so. And if you do this for n steps, you'll get B at some future time, capital N. It's this product thing here from B naught, your initial B. And if you take the logs, this, of course, becomes just the summation, which, assuming your delta T, say, are small, even if your alpha aren't small, approximates to this term here, where you've just got your initial field plus this thing here. But this thing here is just the sum. If alpha is indeed a noise, some sort of small independent random perturbations, this is just something which will sum by central limit theorem to give a normal distribution. So log beta n by this argument would have a normal distribution. And as a result, b, log b would be log normal, so b would be log normal. So obviously, the application to the magnetic field is unclear because we've used this simplistic equation. In the real dynamo, of course, there are vector fields, there's all sorts of complications going on. There's also diffusion, of course. But our motivation was that there might still, nevertheless, be some reflection of noise in the U term, and of course this would work if we just labelled it U instead of alpha. There's nothing mean fieldy necessary here. We wanted to see if there was any impact of this on the outcoming
your
statistics.
Alpha there has zero mean, does it? Well, independent can be positive or negative.
Yeah, yes. For this, yes. Which okay. I guess is not true of the one which I'll talk about in a second.
The implication of taking the logarithm at the bottom is that B is more likely to be negative. Well, speaking as someone who doesn't know about complex numbers. So is there some requirement that B be positive? Because presumably you could...
Well, again...
Looking ahead, you could, I suppose, treat your magnetic field as plus or minus.
Yeah, I guess, well, when it changed sign, you'd maybe have to re-express it in terms of minus B. And I'm not sure, I mean...
This is a logical
sequence. Yes, yeah, the same argument will apply either side. Okay, so just to see if we could see any sign of this in some sort of calculation, we decided to investigate it with a toy model of reversals. Okay, so if I just concentrate on the first three equations on the first two lines here, the core of this is really just a 3-ODE low-order system for reversing dynamos, where we've got a ploidal field S, a toroidal field T, and some sort of omega effect, differential equation sort of effect omega. yeah, there's this alpha here, which we'll get into later on. We'll do something more complex with it ultimately. But if this was just solved for constant alpha, for alpha large enough, you'd get chaotic dynamics just out of this three equation set of equations to start with. This one, in fact, is quite similar to the Rikitaki set of equations first studied back in the late 50s. If you remove these additional, well, there's an additional non-linearity for the magnetic field back on the rotation, which we've imposed here just to make it more general. And we've also put some damping of our rotation, but that doesn't seem important anyway. If you remove these terms here, then, and reinterpret S and T as the currents in a Rikitaki two-disc dynamos, this is actually very close to Rikitaki. In his case, instead of an alpha, you'd have another omega, which is just a constant offset from the omega we're calling. So this, well, for some parameter regimes with constant alpha, does just behave like a Rikitaki type reversing thing, which doesn't produce statistics particularly like the Earth. But if we're going to do, we can do something with this alpha to make it a much more intermittently noisy term, not just a constant term, and get more interesting statistics. So what we've actually decided to do here, and I won't go into the details here, is just, well, partly just from our motivation, because our motivation for this really came about when we read a paper by Clément Marteau and Limuel, who did something similar for an alpha squared dynamo, linking it to a phenomenological model of turbulence. We wanted to try it with at least a model of turbulence with some more basis in the Navier-Stokes equation, so we took one of these shell models of turbulence. So in some sense, we're linking one toy model to another toy model for at least some sort of self-consistent coupled dynamical system. So I won't say much about it at all, but here we're just imagining there's capital N modes labeled with little n, which reflect the Kolmogorov cascade of energy. And in terms of this shell model, there's a natural quantity which represents the helicity in terms of the values of these un at wave numbers kn. And so we've just used this to calculate the alpha, and that's the actual term we've used for just some constant xi alpha, and fed it into this thing here. Well, in fact, in the paper that I put in the wiki...
You don't have any feedback of the presence of helicity on the shell model?
We don't have any feedback of helicity on the shell, but we do, which I skipped over here to keep it all in one slide, we do have feedback of the magnetic field on the shell model. This forcing term actually has a Lorentz feedback type term.
Indirect.
Just yes. Indirect, yeah, it's filtered through the shell model. So, okay, in the paper that was on the wiki, we did it in this form. We subsequently found an earlier paper by Frick and Sokolov where they pointed out a technical matter of the shell model. It perhaps makes more sense to do it this way. So we've subsequently done calculations using this definition of alpha, which actually produced slightly better statistics, which will be on the next slide or so. We've also incorporated a turbulent diffusivity. So instead of a kappa here, we've had things like kappa plus beta, where beta is also calculated from the shell model. And in terms of our motivation, this may seem like overkill, because in terms of the multiplicative noise argument, perhaps we just needed to put some stochastic noise into the alpha term here. But we have tried that, and the statistics we get out of the model don't look as log normal. So the multiplicative noise argument, of course, isn't everything. And it does seem to be that there's something in this shell model that is, perhaps through the actual distribution of alpha we get out of this, helping us produce more Earth-like reversals from this field. I mean, the alpha that comes out of this is very intermittent.
When you tie yourself to shell model, if you just show the three equations and run random alpha...
Well, we've never yet come up with a prescription.
You'll be free of your shells.
Yeah, we've never yet come up with a prescription for the random alpha, which
right.
gives us good results. I mean, we've tried Gaussian noise and random alpha, and the results are nowhere near as good. We might come up with a better prescription of the PDF of alpha that comes out of this, but we haven't yet done it. It doesn't seem to conform to any distribution we've tested so far. And it may be that the subtle feedback between the magnetic field and the alpha filtered through the shell model, however it's doing it, it may be doing something we've not been able to reproduce through a stochastic alpha.
Do they argue why this should be the relationship?
Just because you take a k and a u from your tau, if you're there's this correlation time tau, and if you express it in terms of un and kn, there's cancellation, and it makes sense that the correlation time will be different on the different scales.
So should the gamma, capital gamma, not emerge also from the shell model?
Well, perhaps it should. As it is, we should. Yeah. Okay. We've never gone that route, but perhaps that would be useful. Okay, so the dynamics of this thing. I haven't actually shown time series because I wanted to save slides and time. But this thing, you can time step it for long periods of time, enough to simulate thousands of reversals. What you tend to find is that the variable t, the toroidal field, and the rotation omega oscillate, change sign quite frequently about non-zero means, so that it's a bit like the solutions. In that sense, it's a bit like the solutions Fritz talked about, whereby the toroidal field changes sign much more regularly than the poloidal field in this one. Meanwhile, the poloidal field is going along in time just with more or less minor fluctuations or excursions, you know, an excursion being linked to a reversal in the underlying toroidal field, but with additional fluctuations linked to this noisy alpha, which is going on there. Okay, so it does this, at least for certain parameter regimes, and so you can get out these sequence of reversals, and you can do a similar test, and using the test on this, we also find that this is pretty well fit by a log normal distribution, but also by similar log logistic type distributions too. But okay, this is just the same plot for the non-dimensionalized time units in our model, and again the equivalent of supercrons, which we are getting over several orders of magnitude here compared to the shortest reversal times, are all falling quite well.
Just to put it, what kind of alpha your shell model produce? It's a random one?
It's very noisy with extreme, it's very intermittent, there's extreme bursts.
So you have a distribution function?
We've plotted histograms, I don't have any to hand, but we haven't been able to fit them to a...
Gaussian?
Sorry?
Gaussian? Should be Gaussian.
No, it's very intermittent. Like the high end, the UN in the shell models have got wide tails.
You start from just like dB over dt is alpha b. If alpha is Gaussian,
but we didn't,
then
this
b
was,
will be log norm.
We don't use this equation. Going back, alpha does not have to be Gaussian for this to work. Alpha could be anything, as long as it's random and independent, it will still work.
As long as it has finite invariance, it will be log normal on
B. It doesn't rely on...
The invariance that counts. Of course, if it's strongly fluctuating, it will take more time.
The sums of the alphas is Gaussian, but the alphas themselves are not.
The theorem ensures you that it's finite
invariance. Why should the variance of alpha be finite? Given the likely power law character of the whole business, and then doesn't that lead us to some game with fractional kinetics or something?
So you're talking something. If B is log norm, alpha should be norm because alpha defines it.
No, the sum of the alpha.
Just take log of
the sum of the alpha.
Gaussian
should be norm.
To get log norm.
But B is not log alpha.
I don't know what shell model produces, that was my question, but originally he started with this alpha.
This alpha does not have to be normal, but whatever it is, as long as it's random.
Yeah, it's not normal, the limit theorem should work to get log norm, and so on. It's approximately normal.
No, it doesn't have to be.
Okay, we can argue about
that. Is that a mean alpha?
There is a mean alpha, so in that respect, as Keith pointed out earlier, this argument isn't quite right.
I think both the mean and the fluctuations matter. I mean, if you think of deriving the way to formulate a sort of a picture for the statistics of this, which is probably your next view graph, is to form a Fokker-Planck equation. The mean will set the drift, the fluctuations in alpha will set the diffusivity. And the question is the diffusivity convergent or not, right? So that's the condition for a kind of quasi-Gaussian Fokker-Planck formulation.
But you can only do it consistently if you have a finite variance.
Right.
Because you have to do it with the right. And there's a corresponding Fokker-Planck equation. Mm-hmm. It's just not local on the...
So I think we do have to go back to the alpha and look at the distribution again, because I don't recall what it is. So I mean, it's clearly not
sales,
normal.
You have small shares, but that's probably not significant.
This thing here? Or this
I mean, in both ends, it's like more tailed than normal.
Yeah, at this end, it's definitely more tailed, which is my next.
Also in the
yeah, I haven't looked at... Maybe it's not. Sorry, Dave. I haven't looked at the small end so much, but yeah, it clearly goes wrong at both ends, as does the real one. Can I take another couple of minutes?
Yes, okay.
Shoot. So, better point at this one. Just to point out that if this is reflected in the inter-reversal event times, we might also expect something to be reflected in the fluctuations in time, the sort of shorter length scale intensity fluctuations of the model. And you can see that again, the log normal and log normal type fits do a reasonable job for the intensities that come out of this model on a shorter time scale, as they do for the real Earth. So here, the red histogram is the intensities S, well, the modulus of the intensities S that come out of our model with next to it a log normal fit. And the black ones are paleomagnetic intensities, the sort of time sequence that Dave and or Fritz showed for the last couple of million years where this exists, and a similar fit here. So I'd have to say, in fact, the log normal here is only a reasonable fit and no better than lots of others. And clearly it goes wrong at both ends of this thing too. So whatever the underlying dynamics, the log normal fit is less well reflected in this thing than in the reversals. So if I can just say one more slide and prompt the final discussion, I guess. We did wonder how this related to the superchrons themselves. I mean, because, well, it's often been assumed in literature that the superchrons are a law unto themselves and reflect some different style of dynamo action than the others. Or what I've shown so far has largely been arguing that that need not potentially be the case, but it's far from clear, and what I'm trying to show in this one says that it does appear that something else is going on at these extreme long events times. So what I'm doing on the left is showing again, some real data. What all I've done here, rather provocatively, is take the original Gradstein and Ogg data set of 350-odd reversals and just add in, cherry-picked, the two additional superchrons that are known or thought to be known in the record. So this one here is the original Cretaceous one. This one here is the Kiamen one, which lasted about 50 to 60 million years, about 200 million years ago. And this one, only recently suggested as the so-called proposed Moyera superchron, which lasted about 20 to 30 million years, about 450 million years ago. Sorry, the Kiamen was about 300 million years ago. And we've just added them to this other data set, so it's not a high integrity data, but the suggestion is that all three of them are deviating from this log normal in a way which corresponds to a heavier tail. So the suggestion is that for these extreme events, you are getting more power law statistics and the change to a Levy-type tail of this distribution. On the right, just for comparison, for some slightly different parameters of our model, we can get a similar heavy tail beyond the log normal in our toy model. So this here, again, is just synthetic crons from our toy model with a log normal fit. And these ones coming off like so. Okay, I'll stop there. Thank you.
Questions?
I mean, is it, going back to the idea of probabilities, is it, you know, in some sense, could you go a little bit further in this type of approach and try to deduce, in some sense, the conditions in some space of gut control parameters that would indicate a high probability of a reversal, right? In other words, which might be a more, again, going to the idea of a Fokker-Planck equation, right? In other words, that might tell you, give you a kind of a evolution of a probability that would indicate that a reversal occurred, and then you could tie that to some physical conditions that are correlated with that high probability. And this may be all hideously nasty to work out in detail, but I mean, has any, have you?
We haven't tried it. It does sound interesting. I don't.
It might reveal more about the physics content of the models and so forth.
Yeah, well, in as far as there is physics content in this simple model.
I'm not as negative as Sasha. So.
Steve,
I like the talk. I have a question that's kind of related to what Pat said. I mean, how sensitive are your results to the underlying dynamical system you chose? Fritz has given a different, if you like, possible bifurcation sequence that could, you know, so the initial one could be a hot bifurcation and then there could be some complicated.
Could you
equally well put a dynamical system that had that as the underlying dynamics and add your shell model and still get the same?
Or some other prescription of alpha. I don't think we could. I think the bottom line is that the reversals we get out of this, there is a lot still in them reflecting the underlying dynamics of the almost ricky-tacky type model. I mean, there are various things that we get out of there, perhaps in some cases strong predictive relationships between intensities of one cycle and the duration of that cycle, which I think go back to the underlying simple dynamical system rather than the alpha.
If you did take a non-linear dynamical system that had the same bifurcation sequence as Fritz was advocating and did the same thing in the shell model, do you think you would get a log normal distribution?
I think we wouldn't necessarily. I mean, it would be interesting to try it. I mean, some of the stuff we've done recently, looking at these intensities, for example, in some sense we would have naively expected the log normal signature from the simple argument to be stronger in that than in the reversals, which isn't the case, which suggests that what got us into it, this simple log-normal argument, might not have been the reason it seemed so clear in the inter-reversal data.
I certainly find it's a very interesting test for dynamo.
That's the positive part.
Statistical, it's a positive part. On the historical part, Kolmogorov, a pure mathematician, Andrei Nikolaevich Kolmogorov, believed that if you take a rock and start breaking it, piece, and then break other piece, still smaller, the distribution function of these sizes will be log normal. Mm-hmm. He wrote on a blackboard, but never tried it himself. Log norm is particular, a very singular distribution. Mm-hmm. It's the only, maybe the only one. It's exactly distribution which is not defined by any number of statistical moments, by mean, second, third, and so on. Mm-hmm. You take infinite number of statistical moments, it's insufficient to define log normal distribution. Okay, it's very simple. Practically, when people...
Why is it then?
It's a theory. But now go to practice. In practice, what people try when they use this in different applications, you try to do it for Dynamo, and I welcome it, what they found in some MHD, maybe, but no citation, people found strange exponent distribution. Mm-hmm. Like exponent which is not x squared like Gaussian, but x to the power of alpha, which alpha is not 2, and interesting stuff. The others found just practical people like a jet propulsion lab do it, a power law ends. Your ends where the high moments are working, and when this theorem of singularity of log norm distribution hits you to the head, so I would rather go to this or try stretch exponent or power law finding. For some reason, it works better and more practical and maybe relevant to the physics of that.
We are working on power law type stuff, and this thing obviously suggests the motivation for it. But one thing I would say is that there was a paper last year that I think Carboni et al. Proposed a Levy distribution for the whole recent reversal sequence. And we did find that just for the earlier one, I showed, excluding these two additional superchrons, we did actually find the log normal remains a better fit than the Levy for the rest of these points. So,
for,
At the extreme, superchrome end, I agree, it's something else appears to be happening, and we're working on exactly how we can explain that.
Do you go back to the first slide? So first of all, what you're doing here is you have a field which is the B field that changes now and then.
Yeah.
But this is not what you're doing the statistics on. You're doing the statistics on the waiting times, which you even have from random walk, first off crossing times and so on, have a very different statistics from just the.
No, that,
random walk itself.
That's certainly something we've worried about. I mean, we've spoken to some statisticians who didn't seem to think it was a problem in this case, but it may be that there is.
Because, you can even have, say, if you have a two-state system that's driven by a wind noise, of course, the field itself has statistics with strong tails, but you just get a Poisson distribution of waves.
Of the waiting time.
But it can still be sort of a sort of threshold process here, which is non-trivial that we get that. But that was sort of just a comment. But what sort of pops into my eye here is that it seems that that you have temporal correlations.
That may well be the case, and certainly the prevailing. Well, the prevailing interpretation of this is in terms of local distributions. It's not time, but it's sequence. It's just
a sequence. Yeah, it's time.
They're in order of time.
Just regroup. You can stress this axis, but you still have lumps.
I agree that none of these tests would be sensitive to. Temporal structure correlations between events in this, so that if you know a good test, we'd like to use it.
The spirit of this overall presentation was to talk about how the Earth might do it, as opposed to how the models might do it.
Uh-huh.
And the suggestion, partly I thought, was that having a solid core tended to give a certain amount of diffusive tendencies and prevent flips. Could a few people who work on this, and this was your theme, of course, is this still the prevailing view as opposed to what the particular dynamical model does? The shell itself would like to
help. As Fritz said, it didn't make any difference in his calculations, although in the original Jones and Hollaback paper, I think they did make a big point with the fact that with geostrophic flow, it was really not. It wasn't just the inner core behavior of the sump, but it was actually helped by the inertia of the. I just don't think we know because we can't do the calculations at the appropriate parameters.
Those parameters are still somewhat further removed from some of the simpler models.
I think what I'd like to see here, the question really here is, I think the extraordinary thing with this is that you can explain, you can get the superchrome, this enormous timescale, out of this system, which everyone assumed would require some
mantle effect,
in particular, it happens to be the timescale mantle convection. But the other thing is, if you put excursions into here, the question is whether you actually need this additional timescale of 5,000 years. I mean, there are physical timescales that, if the physical timescales control the statistics, you won't get anything as simple as this. The prevailing view is that you can't explain the statistics with a single model, with a single timescale, which is precisely what we've done.
Yeah.
And you haven't really the excursions.
You're right. I guess they would be implicitly in there with the intensity data, which we did try and fit, which looks okayish, but is not such a good fit.
You do have lots of timescales. I mean, you have a timescale associated with your dynamical system.
Yeah.
You then have a timescale associated with your shell model, which is depending on the parameters. Timescale for fluctuations. And once you have two timescales, then
then the comparison of those timescales with the realistic ones in the Earth would be of interest, because the prevailing theory in the Earth is that there's no timescale within the core, which can explain the supercore.
Before,
And I think it's Chris Jones and one study I was thinking of that attempt to explain the supercrons, which is this great outlier in terms of, based on simple equations, I don't know what to call that. It's an alpha omega sort of infinite domain model, and they couldn't get the thing to actually sort of change its behavior for what amounts to 3 million over 10 times, I mean, in terms of 3 million advection times, or whatever it is in diffusion times. I mean, the supercron lasts an enormous amount of time. So that's why I think it's
different. May, of course, it may be in the Earth that there really is something fundamental acting on long timescales, and that, of course, is very plausible. The motivation for this was to show that at least for this 166 million years that we have good reversal data on, that needn't necessarily be the case. And
questions, comments? Well, let's thank Graham again. To all the speakers
and the chair.
Can you all send me your talk?